Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 63, recorded Sunday, March 30th, 2008. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on today's Travel Commons Podcast: the 733-mile stair and the TSA. They just can't help themselves. Well, this week, coming to you again from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois. I just got back from a spring break vacation, doing a bit of skiing in Colorado. Spent time with my family in Evergreen, which is just up the hill, up I-70 from Denver. Skied Breckenridge and a basin. You know, lots of skiers over from Europe taking advantage of the weak dollar. There were a couple of times in the lift lines, I think I was the only American in sort of a 10-person radius. I heard a lot of English accents, a good bit of Spanish, some French, some German, and I don't know, a couple of languages I didn't recognize at all. However they said it, though, everyone seemed to be enjoying the snow. And I'll tell you, for all the travel hassles caused by the snow this year, I was just happy for at least a couple of days where I was actually able to enjoy snow. I actually looked forward to the sight of snow. So it was nice, like I said, even if it was just for a few days. Returning home last Thursday, I was kind of looking forward to hitting Denver's security line because I wanted to try out the TSA's new Diamond Lane program. This is the one modeled after the Ski Run rating system, which I now had my mind refreshed around. The green circle, which, say, in Breckenridge is for beginner skiers, is for families and groups at Denver International Airport. The blue intermediate square is for the casual traveler, and the black diamond is those who travel frequently and with little luggage, according to the TSA. I don't know, it's an interesting concept. A lot has been written about it. The TSA's Evolution of Security blog, and we all have got opinions on the title of that blog. Well, anyhow, the blog claims that throughput has increased up to 35% during our busiest peak times in the expert lanes at the pilot airports. In fact, in Salt Lake City, a news crew covering the program had to wait several hours to experience a 5-minute wait time. Well, that's according to the TSA blog. My experience was a little different. Because I flew Frontier, which flies out of DIA's first terminal, Concourse A, I actually had a couple of options. You could either take the escalator down to the main security area or take the moving walkway across to the separate Concourse A security area. And looking down on the main security area, the one with this new Diamond Lane program, the line was making at least 5 turns through the Disney World-style maze. Now, looking up, there's a TV monitor that was displaying real-time video from a camera pointed at the Concourse A ID checker stand. This is the one without the Diamond Lane program. It showed no waiting. So as much as I would have really liked to give you guys a firsthand experience with the TSA's latest and greatest way to trim security lines, I decided instead to take the short line, take the moving walkway, walk right through security, catch a beer in the Cowboy Bar, and watch the end of a great Xavier West Virginia basketball game. So, following up, we've got a lot of good stuff for this episode. A quick note to add on the flying green thread that we started a few episodes back. Evan Sparks, he writes the Aviation Policy blog, and he picked up the story of a February 9th American Airlines flight from Chicago to London that ended up carrying only 5 passengers, and there was quite a resulting ruckus raised by environmental groups. Evan, in his blog, writes, "The advocacy group Friends of the Earth considers it an obscene waste of fuel that raised each of the 5 travelers' carbon footprints by 45 times. Of course, there's a sensible explanation for why the airline didn't just scuttle the flight. American Airlines said this would have left a plane load of westbound passengers stranded in London Heathrow who were due to fly back to the U.S. on the same aircraft. We sought alternative flights for the westbound passengers, but heavy loads out of London that day meant that this was not possible. What is the environmentalist solution? They say governments must stop granting the aviation industry the unfair privileges that allow this to happen by taxing aviation fuel and including emissions from aviation in international agreements to tackle climate change. Well, Evan says these measures would have changed nothing about the total environmental impact of the February 9th flight. America needed the plane to be in London that day, emissions trading scheme or not, so it would have just had to bite the bullet and pony up for its environmental impact. Emissions trading programs are meant to reduce the environmental impact of aviation systematically, not in one-off circumstances. It's dishonest, according to Evan, of Friends of the Earth not to acknowledge that their solutions would end up costing travelers more without ending these rare sorts of trips. Now, for me, I'll tell you, in going through this story, I was sort of put off by the Friends of the Earth folks demonizing the travelers who were just trying to get home or trying to get to their job or trying to get to their families. Yes, this flight was a huge waste of fuel and one that cost American Airlines about $60,000. So I don't think they did it without a good bit of cost-benefit calculation. The Friends of the Earth spokesman rants about the five people on the eastbound flight, but conveniently forgets about the hundreds of people who would have been left stranded the next day in London if that 777 wasn't in Heathrow. This flight was a fluke. I mean, I can count on one hand the number of flights I've taken this year where the seat next to me was empty, let alone any flight where I was one of five passengers. That's never happened. I'll tell you, the Friends would be a bit more effective if they focused on real environmental problems rather than sort of cheap shot headline mongering. Now, in the last episode, I treated you all to a good, I would say, couple minute whine, and that's whine with an H, on why I hate to go to business conferences at Disney World. Gary Learned, who blogs his Road Warrior Tales at 6d.tumblr.com, and there's a link in the show notes to this, told his own story in a comment he left on the Travel Commons website. Gary writes, "I had to smile as you were recounting your experience at Disney World. It reminded me of a recent trip to the Gaylord Opryland at the same time that they were hosting a meeting of the International Red Hat Society. While I'm sure this is a great organization, if you're over 50, female, and in search of fun, it is not what I was looking forward to walking into upon my arrival. Hosting about 5,000 Red Hats, the lobby was filled. As this is a resort hotel rather than, say, a Marriott where I have status, I waited in line for about an hour while each of the ladies was asking similar questions about resort fees and all the incidental charges on their bill. When I finally got to the counter, I too was informed that my room was not ready. It was about noontime, and that I'd have to come back after 3 p.m. Trying to find a quiet place to work was as challenging for me as it was for you, Mark. I finally ended up in an employee-only area where they stored wheelchairs. Now, the Gaylord is huge. The walk to my room was about 15 minutes with no traffic. When the halls and walkways were filled with vacationing people traveling in clumps, it became sort of a 25-minute obstacle course each time. Now, before I'm cast as someone who has it out for Red Hats or 50-year-old women out for a good time or vacationers in general, let me just say that I think the Gaylord was the perfect hotel for their convention. It catered well to them, and from what I could see, they were all having a marvelous time. What is painful is when business events are scheduled in the same facilities. Earlier I mentioned the resort fees. One of the benefits that you didn't mention, Mark, about staying at a hotel like Disney World or the Gaylord are the added resort fees to cover amenities like towels that, as a business traveler, you have no intention of using. By the time I added resort fees, associated taxes, etc., the room rate ended up being about $40 a night higher than the quoted rate. My plea to conference and event planners everywhere, please, please plan your events around hotels that understand business travel. I don't know, 50,000 single women over 50 in red hats. Oh my. I'll tell you, Gary, you've got me beat on that one. I thought that I had it bad for kids screaming for Mickey. But I think your conclusion is right. We've just got to avoid We've just got to avoid these hotels when we're there just trying to get some business done. Sarah Bargava, a longtime Travel Commons listener and musical contributor, he actually provided all the bridge music for episode number 49. Sarab sends along his account of a particularly bad day in Newark. As an experienced business traveler, the normal chaos of travel should do very little at this point to frustrate us about the travel experience. Delays and cancellations are part of the package, and as a result, we road warriors come prepared with books, movies, and music, and often even purchase access to the airport lounges to ease the hassles. But I think there is one part of the travel experience that is becoming increasingly aggravating, the endless supply of standing in lines. A few weeks ago, I had a particularly bad experience at Newark Airport. First, there was a line to return the car. A few yards later, I found myself waiting in line to board the air train to get to the terminals. There was some problem that day, so the wait was considerably long. I had printed my boarding pass online and was only traveling with a carry-on bag, but otherwise I could have expected to be waiting in yet another line to get my boarding pass and to check my bags. Well, I was able to skip that step, but then I encountered my next line just to get through the initial TSA agent who was checking my ID. Once past that checkpoint, I joined the group waiting in line to get to the metal detector, and Newark is particularly bad at this. Okay, another line completed, and I get to the gate only to find everyone is queuing up for the boarding process. We started moving, the agent scans my boarding pass, and I walk down the jet bridge. Guess what? Another line just to get on the plane and stow bags. Finally, I sit down and begin to relax. The plane pulls back. The pilot comes on the PA. Well, folks, we're currently 20th in line for takeoff. It took nearly 2 hours when all was said and done, and I had traversed a net distance of what, say 500 yards? As far as I can tell, it comes down to the four following trouble spots. Number one, the check-in process. I mean, has this, other than kiosks, has this improved in the past 25 years? Number two, the TSA. Well, at least some airports have special lines for premier travelers. Otherwise, you've got to pay money for CLEAR or a registered traveler program. Three, the boarding process. Major airlines are currently experimenting with new techniques. Four, air traffic control. Can Congress just get something done here? So it sounds like at least the travel industry recognizes it's a problem, these lines. Now, let's wait and see if it ever gets solved. Well, Sarab, I flew in and out of Newark earlier this month, and I'll tell you, it never ceases to amaze me what a lousy airport it is. I mean, we've talked about this in many episodes. The single thing most frequent travelers focus on is line avoidance. And that's why flyers will pay more to fly on an airline on which they have status, so they can take advantage of, you know, of shorter lines, special lines, premier lines. That's why frequent travelers will consider paying $100 a year for CLEAR or another registered flyer program. And it's why they'll pay $300 to $400 a year for airline clubs. More than anything, the parade of lines just grinds you down. And it's a cumulative thing. Occasional flyers don't feel it, but when you're flying two, three, four times a week, it just starts to add up. Well, thanks to Sarab and Gary and everyone who contributes their thoughts, stories, comments, the voice of the traveler. The email address, as always, comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or you can post them on the website at travelcommons.com. The first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is the 733-mile stair. You know, during the Vietnam War, the thousand-yard stare described sort of that dazed look, the unfocused, straight-ahead gaze of the frontline soldier. Now, I want to say up front that I in no way, shape, or form equate the mortal dangers faced by soldiers with the minor hassles dealt with by frequent travelers. That being said, and that's an important caveat to be said, I'll tell you, the regular travelers on the Chicago to New York run, be it going into LaGuardia or Newark or JFK, are starting to develop their own dazed look, their own sort of shuffling gait as they try to fight through lines, delays, cancellations to get home or to get to an important meeting. Call it the 733-mile stair, the flight mileage between O'Hare to LaGuardia. But I'll tell you, it's becoming a defining feature of a subset of frequent travelers. I mean, looking at a flight earlier this month, it wasn't that bad a day for LaGuardia. Some strong gusts of wind in the morning had, you know, by the end of the day, managed to, turn everything into a two-hour departure delay. I had snagged sort of a very rare first-class upgrade on the 7 p.m. flight back to O'Hare, but when I got to LaGuardia at 6:15 p.m., 45 minutes before my flight was due to arrive, I'd found that the 5 p.m. flight still was there. So it was time to call an audible. I gave up a couple of free drinks, no big deal, but a bigger sacrifice, 7 inches of leg room, and ended up moving from seat 2B on the 7 p.m. flight to seat 30F on the 5 p.m. now rescheduled to 6:45 p.m. flight. All this to have a chance to see my kids before they went to bed. It really wasn't that bad of a trade-off, actually. I mean, I even arrived earlier, 20 minutes earlier, than my 7 p.m. flight would have arrived in O'Hare if it had been on time. However, life wasn't so good for the guy sitting next to me in seat 30D. He laid his jacket on the middle seat, loosened his tie, rolled up his cuffs, dropped his head, and was asleep, sitting straight up, before we had pushed back from the gate. When the drink cart rolled by, he bought 2 bottles of white wine to my 1 bottle of red. Halfway through my bottle, the plane hit some pretty big turbulence. We were bouncing up and down a good bit, and my wine was sloshing just up to the rim of that little plastic cup. The guy saw this and moved his jacket to his lap, saying a bit wearily, "Oh, that would have been just the perfect end to a really lousy day." He was trying to get home to Omaha. He had not been able to move up, so he was taking the full hour and a half, 2 hour delay, was certain he had missed his connection, and wasn't confident that he had many alternatives. You know, I guess this shouldn't be that surprising. An article in last week's USA Today said that based on 2007 passenger counts, the O'Hare to LaGuardia route was the third busiest in the country, and it's really the busiest business travel route. It's the route number one, or the busiest route. The busiest two routes are more leisure-driven routes, Atlanta to Orlando and Honolulu to Maui. Now, the day before I left for my Colorado vacation, week before last, I was not quite so lucky. Poor weather in New York led LaGuardia to implement the FAA's new traffic reduction program, which really just meant canceling about 25% of the flights. So I had no chance of staying on time by moving up to an earlier delayed flight. They had all been canceled. So instead, I sat at the bar with the rest of the road warriors, our 733-mile stair fixed first on the TV showing ESPN, then at our Blackberries as we received emails with updated departure times, and those times were moving back, not coming forward. And then looking out the window, lots of rain, but no planes coming or going. My 5 p.m. United flight finally boarded for what was now an 8:40 p.m. departure. Walking down the jet bridge, another LaGuardia to O'Hare veteran said, "Oh great, they're boarding us. We push back and we're going to be what, number 35 for departure?" I looked at him, I said, "You know, it could be worse. I've been number 42 before." His eyes widened. So we trudged down the aisle. We stowed our bags. This guy and I, we were actually in the same row across the aisle from each other. Plane finished boarding, pushed back. We looked at each other, waiting for the pilot's announcement. Were we going to be 35th for departure? Were we going to be 42nd in line? Were we maybe going to get lucky and be like Sarab, had going out of Newark, be number 20? Where were we going to be? "Flight attendants, please take your seats," said the pilot. "We're number 2 for departure." And I looked across the row at the other guy. Our stairs had been broken. We just looked at each other, gave each other the thumbs up. We were actually on our way home. Mm-hmm. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is TSA. They just can't help themselves. You know, I haven't spoken much about the TSA recently because, well, everybody else does, and I'm not sure I've got too much of anything new to add. I mean, I still think the TSA really means twit standing around, and I think the shoe carnival is still a joke, as is the liquid ban. And I don't think that for the billions of dollars spent and the millions of travelers' hours wasted, we're incrementally any safer. The TSA keeps telling us that we're safer, but when asked for proof, they always say, well, that's classified. You'll just have to trust us. Well, I'll tell you, given my typical experience with the TSA, that's not likely. You know, nothing new there, but I'll tell you, two recent incidents just forced me to say something, made me sort of break cover. The first has been well publicized, last week's incident where the TSA screeners in Lubbock, Texas, forced a female passenger to painfully remove her nipple rings with pliers after they set off the metal detector. Instead of using just some common sense and taking up the woman on her offer to display the rings to a female TSA screener, I mean, I would have just sort of passed this off as another set of TSA screeners on a power trip. Except for the fact that the TSA posted a statement on their website and on their blog saying that the screeners properly follow procedures and that they were acting to protect the passengers and crews of the flights departing Lubbock that day. I mean, I can't believe that someone could write that with a straight face. I mean, if after all we've invested in the TSA, two nipple rings can endanger an airport, I mean, we just ought to fire the whole lot of them and start over again. Now, the second incident never made the press, and indeed, I think I was really the only one who noticed it. I was at O'Hare riding the monorail from remote parking because the deck was full at 10 a.m., but that's a topic for another episode. Anyhow, the monorail, as it was making its way from remote parking, stopped first at the international terminal, Terminal 5, and an older Chinese couple stepped on. You could tell that they were trying to make a connection, trying to make a domestic transfer, and they didn't speak much English. The woman was visibly upset, just short of tears, I don't know, out of fear or frustration or confusion or all of the above. Now, a TSA agent, he was an older, stockier guy. He sort of had that classic fire plug cop build. I mean, and he was either on a break or transiting between terminals, but I could see him try to explain to the couple which stop they should get off the train. Now, he tried a couple of times pointing up to the map, but, you know, he could tell that they weren't getting it. So finally, he gave up, and he said, and he kind of hand signaled to them, follow me, and stayed with them from Terminal 5 to Terminal 1, escorted them off the train, up the escalator, over the bridge, and into the terminal. Now, there's quite a difference. I mean, the Lubbock twits sort of thump their chests and justify the unnecessary pain and distress they caused on a person, just, I mean, with the excuse, well, we were just following procedures. And then they wonder why people so viscerally hate them. In O'Hare, the TSA saw a couple of people in trouble and took the time to help them out. There were no procedures around it. He was just being a good, decent guy who cared about these travelers. Why can't the TSA in general act more like this guy, more like an organization committed to helping travelers, rather than one working hard to find new ways to make our lives more miserable and then making stupid excuses for it? I mean, just a little respect for the taxpayers footing the bill, just a little accommodation for those travelers. That's all we ask. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 63. I hope you all enjoyed this episode and hope you decide to stay subscribed. The bridge music today is actually from a couple of sources. The first song, Three Ghosts One, and the three is an Arabic numeral and the one is a Roman numeral, is from the new instrumental downloadable collection, Ghosts One through Four, from Nine Inch Nails. I've got a link in the show notes. The next two songs are from IotaNet, Ghost Hardware from Burial. I guess we got a ghost theme going on here. And Lonely Dog Blues from Tobin James. Check out the show notes, as always, for links. Hey, and if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or MP3 file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or post them on our website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who's taken the time to send in emails and to post comments on the website. As always, remember, please sort of check out the website. I do try and blog at least a couple of entries between shows. So check it out for some quick thoughts that sometimes don't quite make it into the podcast. And as always, thanks again for stopping along, stopping by the Travel Commons. And until next time, take care. Bye now.
Home alone, life is hell. Strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing can ease my mind, the warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling,